Good morning. Let's begin, as we normally do, today's activity of discussing Dharma by spending a few moments concentrating our whole attention upon the breath, the sensation of the air as it enters and leaves the nostrils. And the purpose is to still our mind, to gain a degree of peace and calm by stopping the train of thoughts, thinking about home and what's happening tomorrow or next week and so on, to try and make manifest the natural state of peace and calm that is a natural aspect of our mind but is usually obscured by too much thinking and anxiety and emotions and so on. So we're going to discuss the Buddha Dharma this weekend, and to do so properly and skillfully, we need to be clearly focused, we need to be mindful of the points that we'll be discussing and retain that knowledge for reflecting upon how it refers to one's own experience in life. And this is the way in which we gain deeper understanding. So beginning, check your physical posture, make sure you're comfortable, and then with your eyes slightly open or lightly closed, focus your whole attention upon the sensation of the air as it crosses the upper lip, entering and leaving the nostrils with each breath. And keep very clear awareness of the coming and going of your breath. Resist the temptation to drift off and think about something else. Now make your mind enthusiastic with the thought that I'm going to engage in listening and participating in a discussion on Dharma in order to be able to train my mind on the path to its full potential of enlightenment. And then you can relax and stop the meditation. Right, so now you know that today we're going to discuss the very important topic of taking refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I think a good approach to this topic is to reflect upon the structure of the mind that was recognized and explained by Sigmund Freud, who was the father of psychoanalysis, a bit more than a century ago in Europe, at a time when psychology and psychiatry were quite infantile in their understanding and methods of the mind. Sigmund Freud was a pioneer in investigating the mind, how it functions. And so some of his conclusions, a little bit controversial from today's point of view, but I'm very impressed by the structure, the simple structure that he presented. He didn't say what mind is, but he did go into great detail about how our thoughts and emotions function. So Freud said that, or explained, that every baby, every newborn baby, has unconscious emotions, unconscious urges and desires, fundamentally desires for pleasure, any pleasure, and desire to be free from pain or the absence of pleasure. Freud called this unconscious source of the desires the id, which literally means the it. He had no further description. He surmised its existence through observation. He said, actually, for ordinary beings, we're not aware of the subtle, unconscious urges that are coming up in our mind. We're not aware of their source, the unconscious or the it, but we are aware of the desires when they come. So he said each new baby has this sort of powerful urges for pleasure and to avoid pain. He called this the pleasure principle. Then he said, as the baby is starting to grow, the reality of life is often frustrates the desire for pleasure and to be free from pain. There is a conflict arises in the mind that what baby wants, baby doesn't necessarily get. And what baby doesn't want, does happen. So even this very, very young mind, a few months old, there's conflict. And the baby's mind is, well, maybe not in terms of language, but in terms of thoughts, there's the feeling, what is going on? And with this feeling of trying to sort out why mum and dad and the environment don't give what I demand, initially we do. Don't, I mean, every newborn baby, mum and dad and others try as much as they can to give the baby what it wants and needs and see it smile. And, you know, that's our reward. And if the baby's crying, do whatever we can to stop the source of pain or whatever it is that is making the baby cry. But as baby grows and gets a bit older, then sometimes these desires are not met. So already, before language, the baby is developing a sense of self, mainly, you know, me, mostly referring to my body, and not me, everything out there. So there's this, already, there's this sense of self arises in the mind of the baby before actual language is developed. And within the sense of self, there's also knowledge born out of experience of what sort of behaviors and what conditions enable baby to get what baby wants and what conditions prevent the baby from getting what it wants. And so this is because of the conflict between the pleasure principle and the reality of life. So in the baby's mind, with the sense of self, there becomes gradually building up this inner world view, this inner view. It's like there's me, then there's mum and dad, maybe my toys. You know, it's sort of gradually expanding. And this is a psychological attempt to resolve the conflict of frustration of the innate urges coming from the subconscious or unconscious. Those of you who were here the last weekend when we were talking about the death process, you can remember during the process of death, the gross thoughts and consciousnesses gradually stop, and once we stop breathing, we're not yet dead. And then there was a presentation of the 80 subtle or primitive conceptions or primitive urges. It seems to me that this could be equated, these primitive urges for pleasure and for pain, to avoid pain, are very close to Freud's presentation of the unconscious, the source of the emotions and desires. Anyway, collectively, the baby's developing awareness of itself and its world and what works and what doesn't work is called the reality principle. So the reality principle is developed in the mind as a result of the pleasure principle being frustrated. And we can equate this accumulation of primitive understanding and knowledge with what Freud called the ego. So literally, ego means I, myself. But it's not just the self-image. For sure, the self-image is an integral part of the ego, but there is much more. There is all of the knowledge and understanding and reasoning that this baby's mind is putting together to sort out what's going on and how to deal with life, how to get pleasure and avoid pain in a skillful way. So, of course, when we talk about knowledge, there's correct knowledge and there's incorrect knowledge. So all of us, from the very young time, when we're developing our sense of self and the world and our situation in the world, some of the knowledge and our memories, this is all included in the ego, these are correct. Some of what we think are knowledge are incorrect. Well, we don't know what's correct and what's incorrect, but there's a mixture. Then, according to Freud, at about 6 months of age, the world is still a little bit frightening, you know, frightening for the growing, developing baby. There's so much the baby doesn't know, so many new situations, which are scary. And so each child identifies with the parents, according to Freud. Initially, we have attraction for the parent of opposite sex, and some hostility towards the parents of the same sex. In males, this is called the Oedipus complex. In females, the Electra. So it's reversed. In females, the Electra complex, referring to Greek divinities in the Greek tales. So, in identifying with mum and dad are the primary sources of protection. In face of this unknown world and the scary situations, then babies rely on mum and dad as role models. We unconsciously absorb their standards of morality, like their way of behaving, which includes whatever ethical standards that mum and dad obey or have adopted in their lives, because we see them as being our protectors, super protectors. We exaggerate in our mind the capacity of mum and dad to give us protection. Like we think they can protect me from everything, and so we have this strong attachment relationship with mum and dad. And so we unconsciously adopt their approach to life, their ethical standards. Very young age. Again, it's not a conscious decision. It's just it happens in the maturing mind of a child. But what happens is that soon the reality of mum and dad becomes clear, that they are not always able to protect us from the fears, the doubts, the worries that we have about ourselves and our life. Their minds can sometimes be overwhelmed by unhappiness, by anxiety, by depression, and they can argue with each other. And this is quite shocking for a baby, to see the emotional instability in mum and dad, and conflict between mum and dad, who the baby has idealized as being perfect protectors. So this is more information for the reality principle, what is going on. So there's disappointment, frustration, and the baby might lean towards others, maybe to grandma or grandpa or auntie or uncle, or even to possessions. You know, young children become so attached to their toys, or, you know, even a soft piece of cloth, like a piece of silk or something, which they hold, and that becomes a source of comfort in the distressing reality of growing up. But it's still getting older. There is a constant experience of disappointment. that the objects that we rely upon for security to make sense of this crazy world keep letting us down. I mean, they might die, or they may manifest their own instability, people we rely upon, the instability, inability to deal with the difficulties in life, and so on. So, we're getting older, and we might even, or we do, we look to other individuals, teachers, famous people in society, athletes, musicians, whoever, actors, actresses, and on the stage, and so on, who we idealize and see them as, that is the person I want to be. And again, it's not necessarily a conscious decision to do this. It's we're like a sponge, and we're soaking up what we consider are good qualities, manifest in the minds of others, and trying to be happy by emulating those famous figures, athletes, etc. I don't know if it happens in Singapore, but I know in London, way back in the 80s, in London, there were, I don't know if you call them fan clubs, but there are groups of people who would totally wear the clothes and dress and try to look like their favorite actress or actor or sports person. And it still happens now. It's a bit weird. In cricket, when you see I go to cricket games, but I sometimes watch it on TV, and the people in the audience, there's whole groups who try to look exactly the same, some famous cricketer, that they wear the wig and the clothes. It's very weird. Of course, there's an element of fun in doing that. But there's also, I think, a more subtle element of identification with these great athletes, great sportsmen, that they become my role model in a psychological manner. But of course, if we read the gossip columns in newspapers, on the internet, and it's so famous, the gossip columns about movie stars from Hollywood, etc., and the royalty, the British royal family, are devastating events indicating that these famous people, royalty, are just like us. And we get let down and become so disappointed because they become the role models. So we're getting older, we're adults now. We're still looking for role models in life. Still experiencing the conflict between these subconscious urges and the reality. So Freud mentioned another aspect of the mind, which he called the superego, the overego. So this refers to the which controls the self. And this is a personal adopting of a code of behavior. We may not yet call it a moral code or a code of ethics, but a way of living, a way of thinking, a way of talking, and even physically dressing, as we've mentioned, to get to make sense of the world and to get the pleasure we want and avoid the pain. So the superego, as I mentioned initially, unconsciously adopts the moral code of one's parents, because the baby sees the parents as perfect. But soon, growing up, the baby realizes that mum and dad aren't perfect, and they can't even maintain their own happiness or prevent their own unhappiness. They can't control the world. So we look to other codes. And then there's religion. So many different philosophies and religions, and they present fundamentally codes of ethics, of avoiding, you know, the main harmful actions, killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, physical, verbal, lying, harsh speech, gossip, and so on, slandering, and the mental non-virtues. So when we look at these, actually they're very similar. You know, the Ten Commandments of Moses, that God gave to Moses, they're like not dissimilar to the ethics of Buddhism based upon the presentation of karma. So there is a similarity, but usually we see you must see God as being the Father who is in heaven. So you see there's immediately a transference of reliance upon one's physical father to still father image, but elevated beyond the imperfect ordinary dad to the perfect God. So the father who says you must do this and don't do that. So, in that way, the superego controls our approach to life and a way of living by adopting a code of morality. And that's valid. Now, from the Buddhist point of view, the essence of practicing Dharma is to act in a virtuous, positive way and to avoid non-virtue. But then, There are limitations. If we adhere to a religion, then those who wear the robes or have the appearance of practitioners of the religion don't necessarily conform to the code of conduct of that religion. In the West, there's a huge a tidal wave of disappointment in priests and monks in the Catholic tradition and the Protestant tradition who totally in their lifestyles through personal desire for physical pleasure break the commandments. And so the representatives of God let one down, and so many people are rejecting, say, in Western countries, they're rejecting Christianity, they're rejecting all forms of religion because the apparent practitioners and the exponents of the religion are lying. They're harming people. They're not practicing. And so one's whole identification with God is destroyed. One's whole ethical foundation is eroded away. And there's a lot of sense of meaninglessness, and people are very upset. But there's still the need for a direction, a safe direction in life. Now, I'm sure you may be aware of Alex Person, who's one of our friends who was a student of in Dharamsala in the early days in the 1970s, and he was a very close disciple and translator for Senshab Tsokhon Rinpoche, who was, I used to call Senshab Tsokhon Rinpoche the grandfather of FPMT. Lama Zopa Rinpoche was so close to him, and he would come at every request from Lama Zopa Rinpoche to Copan and to visit the FPMT centers and give talks. And so wonderful. Anyway, Alex Person incredible scholar, and he, if you read his books, it's difficult to comprehend because he uses the terminology, the exact, to get the exact meaning rather than conventional meaning. And instead of using the term refuge, he talks about seeking or taking a safe direction in life. And that is exactly what our whole ego has been developed to achieve, a safe direction. How to live our life in a secure way to progress from happiness to happiness and to avoid suffering and danger. So refuge in the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So we might think, well, yes, but this is the same as the other religions. If you take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then you become a Buddhist and you got the right direction. It's not exactly the same in that in the whole Judeo-Christian Islamic presentation of the Father God in the sky saying, do this, don't do that. There is not a presentation of why you should do this and don't do that. Oh, what? Because God said. But God said isn't enough. Particularly for us in this day and age who have, you know, a much broader view of life, a scientific view of life. And we want logic. We want reasoning. In Buddhism, the presentation of the objects of refuge, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, greatly explains what Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha are. Buddhism greatly explains the cause of suffering as being internal in our own minds. The cause of suffering is contained within our ego, our self-image, and our worldview, what we have developed to think this is how the world exists. But as I said, although ego covers our whole accumulation of knowledge through experience, some of that knowledge is correct, some of that knowledge is incorrect. And Buddhism points out, you know, the fundamental mistake in our self-image as being, you know, an inherently existing me, is mistaken. So the very foundation stone of our whole ego is mistaken. But that doesn't mean that the edifice that's built upon the self-image is totally wrong. There are aspects which are correct and aspects which are incorrect. And it is the mistaken foundation and the incorrect aspects, self-centeredness, pride, anger, attachment, and so on, which are the root cause of suffering. So this is explained in Buddhism. So, the opposite of those causes of suffering, which we can recognize, if we really check up, when we're miserable, and if we're honest with ourselves, we can see that the root problem is inside here, not the person out there or the situation out there. It's in here. We can recognize that. So we don't have to adopt a moral code of observing karma because Buddha said so. It's logical that anger, which an attachment, and pride, and jealousy, which lead to the non-virtuous actions, they are suffering themselves, and whether we believe in Buddha or not, or God or not, if we follow them, we create suffering. So it's reasonable to abandon non-virtue, and we can also see that generosity and kindness and patience and compassion and so on, and wisdom do bring inner peace and happiness. So logically, yes, I should train my mind in virtue. Not because Buddha said so, but because I know it's true from my experience of life. So, having checked up like that, then the act of taking refuge is recognizing the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and incorporating our understanding of what they are into our self-image, into our ego, and following the path to enlightenment. So you see, and the superego is the code of morality indicated by Buddha Dhamma. And in the Buddhist path, there are the three levels of vows, the Pratimoksha or self-liberation vows, lay people and ordained people, then there's the Bodhisattva vows and the Tantric vows. The Pratimoksha vows mainly are overcome physical non-virtue and verbal non-virtue. The Bodhisattva vows are more directed towards mental non-virtue. The Tantric vows are completely meant to overcome mental non-virtue, the hardest non-virtue to restrain from. So we need in the beginning, we see Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as external objects of refuge. That's called the causal refuge. But as we mature on the path to enlightenment, internally we acquire the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So we internalize the refuge. So initially we rely upon our idea of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha out externally and represented by images and so on and texts. But as we mature and we internalize, we have the inner Buddha, the inner Dhamma, and the inner Sangha in our own mind. And that is unshakable. Our self-confidence and our self-esteem are completely capable of overcoming or dealing with whatever problem arises. You see, we need self-confidence, we need self-esteem to live in life, to succeed in just staying alive. Mum and Dad gave us the self-confidence when we were very young. Then their power to act as role models weakened, so we looked for other role models, which gave us more strength, self-confidence, self-esteem, to get through the more detailed aspects of life and other role models. And like, there are lots and lots of valid role models to a degree in society. But unless beings are actual representatives and practitioners of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, they can only lead us so far. So taking refuge is initially to generate the strength and confidence to practice Dhamma, to oppose the real problems which are in here. So many religions, there's so many wars and conflict and harm because the problem is said to be out there. The problem is the devil, the fallen angel who is the real problem. Or it's the other religion, other worshippers, people who belong to something. So they are the source of problem and evil. They are to be eliminated. And there's such a history of religious conflict in human history throughout the world. never resolves the problems. No matter you exterminate a whole culture, a whole, it doesn't stop your problems, it creates more problems. There's not, Buddhism is unique in identifying the root problem to be internal, in our own mind. Self-grasping ignorance, self-centered anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, as the root problem. Yes, those emotions are recognized as problems, but the root, self-grasping ignorance, is not mentioned. And the solution, the emptiness of existing in the mistaken way we think we exist, is not there. There are temporary patches or band-aids for the problem, but not solutions. Anyway, so that's the subject of this weekend, or this today's talks, is the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and why they are valid objects of refuge. I think I mentioned when I first met the Dhamma at Kovan Monastery back in 1974, I was traveling with my girlfriend, and she, at the end of this four-week course, she took refuge. And although I'd been deeply impressed by Lama Yeshe, Lama Tumazova Rinpoche, I advised her not to. Because in my mind, I wasn't sure. The psychology, but not the karma and reincarnation, that was difficult to incorporate. And I knew the importance of taking refuge, that it has to come from total conviction, understanding, and should never be abandoned. And so I didn't attend refuge ceremony. I said, I've got to learn more. I'm not ready. She did. And she's still a Buddhist. And she became a very close disciple of Goenka, the Burmese meditation master, who was doing a lot of teaching in those days in India. And she was one of the founding members of Goenka's meditation centers in Australia, near Sydney and north in Queensland and so on. But no, I had to go back to the West. I had to check up about karma and reincarnation. And it took a while. But I did so many things. And after living in Europe, in England for some time, and seeing that politics wasn't the solution, that even the family situation, because in England, living with another lady and her two children, and very domestic and very nice, but no, that wasn't the root, that wasn't the solution. So I recognized it. In my mind, there was anger, uncontrolled emotions, and so on. And there's and that was important, because although I had unbelievable parents, who everybody loved them, still, my father had uncontrolled anger. And most people, our friends, didn't see that. But I knew it. At a very young age, being disappointed with my father, who as a young child I'd seen as a super person, had this problem with anger. And as a very young child, I mean, I will never be like that when I grow up. But I was like that. And at times, in England, I reckon that when I was manifesting anger, I thought, wow, this is just like my father. And with that realization, I knew that I had to learn more about Buddhism. I went back to India, met Goenka, and did two courses with Goenkaji in Benares. And after that, we finished on Christmas Eve, the 20 days of meditation, and we caught the train to Bodh Gaya, And Bogaya in those days was so peaceful, 1974. So, nobody there. Sit under the Bodhi tree for hours and not see anybody. So I was meditating under the Bodhi tree and thinking about karma and reincarnation, which I've been thinking about constantly since meeting Lama Sopa and Lama Eshi, 9 months before. And I incorporated these into my worldview. I can't say what it was, but they were harmonious with all the other things that the lamas had taught me about Buddhism. So I took refuge with a Kagyu Lama who was there. So things changed. Amazingly, life seemed to go so well. But I won't go into that. But it was, I knew how important that step was. Now, to get down to the actual presentation from the Lama Room, the graduated path. The reasons for taking refuge. So at this point in the graduated path, we've meditated on the perfect human rebirth. We've meditated, you know, essentially, being born as a human in a situation where one meets the Dharma and has all the necessary conditions to practice Dharma. But death and impermanence are forever present. And how long we've got that situation, we don't know. The next meditation, the sufferings of rebirth in the three lower realms, animals, hungry ghosts, hell realms. So if we die before we have had the chance to practice Dharma, there's this danger, this incredible danger of going back to the three lower realms from where we came. So then there is the next outline is the presentation of taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as the foundation for observing karma. So the two reasons for taking refuge are a healthy fear of death and rebirth in the three lower realms. That is the first level of refuge. And I say healthy fear because there's a lot of objections to thinking about the sufferings of animals, hungry ghosts and hell beings. We think, oh, well, you're making me scared. This isn't helping me. But it is healthy because there is this real danger. And if we're not aware of the danger, we're not going to do anything about it. You know? If we're in a strange country and we want to go to a town where we have to go through a forest, well, we might sit out just to walk through the forest of the town. But someone says, hey, be careful. There are these man-eating tigers in that forest. They killed so many people. So they make us afraid of the tigers. So we do something to avoid being eaten by the tigers. We take a whole army with us to protect whatever. That's a healthy fear. At the initial scope, to work, to train one's mind, observe karma, to have a happy rebirth and avoid suffering in the three lower realms, the fear is just that, fear of being born in an unhappy state. At the second scope, one meditates on the Four Noble Truths and the sufferings of humans and the sufferings of the divine beings. And one realizes that even though there's so much more pleasure as humans and divine beings, still there's the suffering of the pervasive suffering of being under the control of karma and disturbing emotions. So if we just, so there's a thought of achieving nirvana, the cessation of karma and afflictions, the blissful mental state called nirvana. So the second level of fear is fear of being born in the upper realms as well as the lower realm. And the third level is the compassionate fear of thinking of others. That although Buddha taught the path to nirvana and I can achieve the path to nirvana, still my suffering will come to an end, but suffering will still exist in the world. And so there's fear for others, for the suffering of others. How can I be so cruel as to abandon my universal family and seek my own freedom? So there's fear of that wish to achieve nirvana, because it will prevent my ability to help those who have helped me in past lives. So there is the, through fear of nirvana, a type of fear, you know. Nirvana isn't suffering for oneself, but it's an inability to help others because you haven't generated the intention to help, to repay the kindness of others. So then the third level is generating the attitude to rescue all beings from suffering and achieve Buddhahood. So that is the third level of fear in terms of the two qualities of mind to go for refuge. The second is faith, confidence, that the three jewels can protect one from those terrors or those things. Buddha, the Buddha jewel, shows the way to avoid harm. He teaches the method which he himself followed. Practicing the Dharma is the only way to overcome negative karma and disturbing emotions. And the Sangha, those who have gained levels of realization on the path, they are the spiritual friends who help and guide one's practice. So healthy fear and faith are the fundamental purposes for taking refuge. Obviously, one has to have some awareness of rebirth and karma and the psychology. When one can see the pattern, then it's obvious that we've been able to see the pattern of reality in dependence on what we've already heard about Buddha's teachings and we've experienced ourselves. So fear and faith are the foundations. Then, so the faith is at different levels. Initially, there can be some admiration, and this can come from what we've heard about Buddhism, or it can even be from past lives, from past connections with the Dharma. We can hear the words, bodhicitta. We can see an image of Buddha, or hear shunyata, or some word which instantly inspires a sense of confidence and trust, and attraction and affinity for the three jewels. So that's called admiring faith. And that attracts us. I think that's what attracted me to Copan the first time. Because I'd been in Singapore and Penang and then Bangkok, traveling with my girlfriend, and then she wanted to go to Nepal to attend the meditation course in March 1974 at Copan. And I said, okay, you go. I'm not getting into this religious thing. So she went. And I was in Bangkok and I was looking for work as a doctor in Thailand. And I had some addresses which doctors I've been working with in Australia, that they knew I was going to Thailand. And they gave me the names and addresses of people to meet. And the first was an American doctor in Bangkok. And I didn't know, but I mean, I had his address and contacted him and met him. And it turned out that he'd been a Buddhist monk for 3 years and then had disrobed and had married a Thai woman and was living in in an apartment in Bangkok. And he was a very impressive person. And so he came to my hotel. We went through the day. We visited Buddhist temples in Bangkok. And I was a bit dubious. And I was looking at him lighting incense and making offerings. And I thought, a bit much. And I told him that a friend of mine had got into Buddhism, Nick Rebush. You may have heard of Nick Rebush, who runs Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives. So we were friends way back in medical school. And I said, a friend of mine's become a monk and his girlfriend's become a nun in Tibetan Buddhism. And it's interesting, because he said, Tibetan Buddhism. No, it's too mysterious. Westerners will never get into Tibetan Buddhism. And somehow, I took that as a challenge. Anyway, cut a long story short, there wasn't a suitable position for me to work as a doctor in Thailand, so I had to speak the language. And I didn't have that. And I had with me a small book on the Lum Rim by Geshe Repton, one of Lama Yeshe's main teachers and Lama Zopa Rinpoche's main teachers, which Nick had published and sent to me, and I'd carried with me for about 18 months and not looked at. So one night, I think it was a full moon night in Chiang Mai, on the hotel, I read this book three times. And I think there was an affinity. The reason for this story is I felt some admiring faith in what was written. You know, particularly the psychology part. I thought, I must go to Nepal. The course was due to start in a week. And also there was a bit of a lingering attachment to my girlfriend who had gone to Nepal. But there was a genuine interest in Buddhism. So admiring faith. Second is faith and conviction. So based upon that, faith and conviction is where we really hear the teachings and we put them into practice and we check up and we question and so on. And so we generate some logical reasoning to support what we've heard. So faith and conviction is much stronger. The admiring faith we can lose. You know, you can be talked out of it. But faith and conviction is based upon logic, and that's much stronger. You can't be talked out of it. And as a result of this, there's the aspiring faith, the thought that, well, this path is possible. I can achieve the different levels of the path. I can achieve inner peace, I can achieve nirvana, I can achieve enlightenment. So it's the aspiration to really practice and the enthusiasm to practice Dharma. So these are three levels of faith. It's called faith because it's not total understanding, total knowledge of the profound meaning of the Dharma. But faith is a necessary precursor to logical understanding and then to the wisdom of meditation, where you do have direct knowledge of shunyata, of karma, of cause and effect, and so on. You can't achieve that meditative wisdom without initially having faith. So faith becomes wisdom, becomes knowledge, then it becomes wisdom. Say, you want to study any mundane subject, and you go to university, you have faith that the professors of your particular topic know what they're talking about, that they're valid teachers. But it's still only faith. You don't know yet. And it takes years of study, etc., to know what they're talking about. No. Buddhism is the same. Okay. So, in the Lum Rim, the outline now goes more deeply into the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And in general, Buddha, an enlightened person, is a suitable object of refuge. So why? Now, in many cultures, people take refuge in worldly spirits. You know, there's a problem, so you make offerings to the local gods who you live in the area and you have maybe have a little temple outside and you light incense and maybe food offering or even make sacrifices of animals and so on, taking refuge in worldly spirits. Now, worldly spirits exist, but they're samsaric. They're fickle. They're not reliable. Sometimes you can get some help from worldly spirits, but you can't be guaranteed. So when we take refuge in the three jewels, in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, you don't have to make offerings. You don't have to offer incense or money or food or prostrations. Those activities are useful, they accumulate merit. But simply having the refuge in your heart, in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, that is your protection. And that comes without the need to buy it. You don't have to buy their protection. It comes because of your state of mind, of conviction and trust in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So many examples in the texts and in the teachings in the Lama Rim of individuals who are experiencing danger and they generate strong refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and they're protected. Well, you know, in the Aryasagata Sutra, there was the man who was sacrificed by the parents of, by mistaken advice of a priest who says, you sacrifice a human and some animals, then your son will be cured from his disease. So it didn't. They did this, they bought a slave, and then they killed him and sacrificed him, and it didn't work anyway. Their son died, and they had died of grief, and then Buddha was asked, well, what happened to the parents? Well, they went to the terrible hells, and the priest went to the hells. And what happened to the man who was sacrificed? He went to the heaven of 33. Why did he go to the heaven of 33? Because as he was being killed, he took refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So the refuge didn't stop him from being killed, but it stopped him from being reborn in a terrible place, and he went to the heaven of 33. So now that's just, I'm sure, there's so many examples. Why is the Buddha, a suitable object of refuge? The Buddha has freed himself from all dangers. So if we want to, you know, that story before about the forest where there's a man-eating tiger, and it's very dangerous to go through that forest, well, we're going to look for somebody who will protect us. So we look for a guide. And many different people are guides, but it's best if the guide is completely free of all danger, is totally capable of dealing with man-eating tigers. There are lots of stories in the sutras of how, you know, people sent mad elephants to harm the Buddha and his followers, and the Buddha, just through meditating on peace and love, subdued the mad elephants, and the Buddha was able to sit on his back and the elephant carried along the road. Lots of stories. People tried to trap the Buddha, poison him, kill him, and so on. But through the power of his realization, he overcame these problems. So the Buddha has freed himself from all dangers. That's the first reason why Buddha's valid refuge. Just as the guide who is free from all danger of being killed by a man-eating tiger, then that's the sort of guide we'll see. Second is the Buddha is skillful and has effective means to free others from fear. Again, you know, there are lots of stories of how the Buddha manifested at one time as a musician, a brilliant musician, to overcome the arrogance of a king who thought he was the greatest musician in the world. And so by subduing the king's arrogance, the king was open to listening to the Dharma. So many stories which you know. So Buddha has effective and skillful means for each individual to give what the individual needs, to overcome obstacles in their mind and practice Dharma. So we want a guide who has skillful means to avoid tigers. Thirdly, the Buddha has complete equanimity and undiscriminating compassion for all sentient beings. This is the definition of Buddhahood, definition of bodhicitta, the intention to equally work for all sentient beings. And again, there are so many stories there where Buddha harmed Devadatta at one stage, or many times. Devadatta tried to kill Buddha, but that never turned the Buddha away from seeing Devadatta as most important in helping. So, again, in our analogy of a guide who's taken us through the forest, then we need to have a guide who will protect us and not just look after some, but who will look after ourselves and the people with us equally. Finally, a Buddha helps others to fulfill their aims whether they have helped him or not. The Buddha doesn't demand a wage, a price, doesn't demand prostration or respect. The only reward that the Buddha seeks is our protection from suffering and our happiness from our practice, from practicing Dharma. That is the way in which to, how say, propitiate, to invoke Buddha's recognition of what we're doing. If we give lots and lots of money, to the Dharma Center, but we're quite interested in having our donation acknowledged, and maybe the honor board on the wall with our name in gold, I donated this for charity in the hospital. They have the honor boards of the donors who support the hospital. If that is our motivation, then that's not a pure action. There is some benefit, of course, but it's an impure, self-centered motivation. Buddha is only interested in us practicing Dharma. The best offering that we can make to our Guru, to our Lama, to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, is to practice Dharma. If we see a suffering insect or animal or bird, and we rescue it, give it food, protect it, offer that virtue to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. That is the offering. If we find ourselves getting agitated and we want to abuse somebody who's hurt us, upset us, if we catch our mind and we don't let those harmful words come out, instead, with skill, we speak calmly and resolve the situation in a peaceful way. And if we consciously offer that virtuous action to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, unbelievable positive energy. And that's all that the Buddha asks for. Our Dharma practice. Why? It's not to enhance Buddha's reputation. It's because Buddha's sole motivation is the happiness and protection from suffering of others, and that comes from practicing Dharma. Okay, so in the notes that's the general presentation of why Buddha is a suitable object of refuge. And when we take refuge in the Buddhachula, we can talk about the relative Buddhachula. And that is the rupakaya, the physical form of the Buddha, which appears in two aspects, as a supreme emanation body in the Pure Lands, but only Arya Bodhisattvas can meet the supreme emanation body. So then there's, the enjoyment body, Then there's the emanation body, whereby, so I made a mistake, it's not the emanation body in the Pure Lands, it's the enjoyment body. The emanation body is a physical body through which Buddhas communicate Dharma to those who aren't Arya Bodhisattvas. So the supreme emanation body is like Shakyamuni Buddha himself, who turns the wheel of Dharma, and then Buddhas appear in many other ways. So this physical body of the Buddha, whether it's an enjoyment body in the Pure Land or an emanation body on earth, then that's the relative Buddha jewel. The ultimate Buddha jewel that we take refuge is the Dharmakaya, the omniscient wisdom body of a Buddha, and the what we call the nature body, Sabhavakaya. We'll talk about these later. In terms of the Dharma jewel, the relative Dharma jewel, is the teachings of Buddha, the three baskets, the Abhidharma, the sutras, and the Vinaya. So, represented by the texts. So that's the relative Dharma jewel. The ultimate Dharma jewel, the ultimate protection, is true cessations and true paths in the minds of all Aryans. So true paths are the wisdom, the levels of wisdom directly realizing emptiness, which cause cessation or extinguishment of the different levels of affliction in the minds of practitioners. This is the true refuge, because it is the afflictions and the karma created through them which is the root cause of suffering. So the true paths, the wisdom realizing emptiness, are that which destroys the suffering, which is our, which is what we're trying to avoid. So that's the the ultimate Dharma jewel. The Sangha jewel, the relative Sangha jewel, is the person of any Arya being. An Arya being is one who has gained direct realization of emptiness. So the robe Sangha represent the Aryas, or a collection of four monks or nuns, represent the Sangha jewel, but they only the actual Sangha jewel if they have the realization of emptiness. And of course, you know, once you have the direct realization of emptiness, there are many levels of the path to complete. So the relative Sangha jewel is the person of any Arya. The ultimate Sangha jewel is so-called the community of true cessations and true paths in the mind of an Arya. So you see, we go from the person to their mind. The true cessations and true paths in their mind is the ultimate Sangha jewel. So that's very briefly what the three jewels are in a relative and ultimate sense. And I've already mentioned that the causal refuge is the three jewels in the continuums of others, and the resultant refuge is the three jewels within our own mental continuum. Now we're going deeper into looking into the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So first, the Buddha. The Buddha's body has the 32 excellent signs and the 80 features. So these signs indicate a great person, and the 80 features signify personal attainment and inner qualities that make positive impressions upon others. One of my teachers, Geshe Nawantagi, who used to teach at the Tibetan Library in Dharamsala both throughout the 70s and early 80s, then Geshe Nawantagi, he said that only those who have great merit will appreciate and develop faith when hearing about the Buddha's qualities. Others will be incredulous, skeptical, and may even misunderstand this presentation of the Buddha's qualities. He said it's crucial to be positive, open-minded, and receptive when we're hearing about the qualities of the Buddha. Then we will be inspired to take refuge and aspire to acquire those qualities ourselves. So we need to think about the meaning of these different signs of a Buddha. He said that many Westerners come to the East in search of direction and meaning in their lives. But only those with faith or respectful belief actually attend the teachings and try to improve themselves. They receive strong imprints that make it easier to develop further good qualities. But those who don't have faith and respect, they may listen to the teachings, but they waste their time socializing, smoking, and sunbaking. And this is exactly what during the 1970s, you would see amongst the hippies, the Westerners who went to Dharamsala to find the Dharma. So the former, those who have respect, return home with a solid foundation and potential for future growth. The latter return home with a suntan, which they quickly lose. I mean, I know well the situation in Dharamsala in those days, and it is so true. Geshe Dagi, one of my gurus for sure, he was terrified me. He could see right through you and had no hesitation in pointing out one's mistakes. But his own demeanor, his own person was so powerful that you couldn't help but have faith in him. Okay. So there's a whole list. Those 32 excellent signs, there are many points. I won't go through them all. So there are it's good to hear what they represent, and that gives respect. So the thousand-spoked wheels on the palms and soles. You see on the painting of Buddha, there's thousand-spoked wheels, the palms, and the soles of the feet. So wherever the Buddha walks, his feet don't actually touch the ground, but there is left on the ground an imprint of a thousand-spoked wheel. So the cause for this is always greeting the guru, going to meet the guru, holding incense and so on, and selflessly serving others. The next sign, these signs may feel a bit weird, smooth soles of the feet. So this sign indicates that due to living in harmony with the Dharma, it's smooth, and firmly keeping the vows, the three types of restraint, the pratimoksha restraint, or pratimoksha vows, restraining ourselves from mental wandering and from dullness, and restraint from the disturbing attitudes or the afflictions that then this restraint arises from seeing reality. So that is what the smooth soles of a Buddha's feet indicate. So we might think, oh, it doesn't, just the sign doesn't mean anything unless we know what it represents in terms of one's practice. Third sign is that there's like a web of light between the fingers, or webs of light, not flesh, but of light. So this sign indicates, or is due to practicing the four activities of gathering disciples, of material generosity, of speaking pleasantly, and of doing meaningful actions. So, you know, these are the four activities of teaching Dharma. Living as one teaches. So when we do the mudra of prostration, said that we should keep our fingers just slightly apart, and this this represents the this sign of the web of light between the fingers. All right, so those are just the first four of the 32 signs. After lunch, we could maybe talk about a few more, and then the special qualities of a Buddha's speech. In all of our, I remember when I was in Mongolia, and most of the temples and the holy objects have been destroyed, but in one, the main temple in Ulaanbaatar, which was the monastery of the kings of Mongolia, who were equivalent to the Dalai Lama practitioners. So many, many holy objects were there, a bit like a museum, but showing unbelievable how deep the practice of Dharma must have been in Mongolia. And it was all Gelugpa Tibetan Buddhism. Not 100%, but mostly. So there's a few of us visiting the museum with Lama Zofa Rinpoche, and Rinpoche said at the beginning, he said, now go to each of these holy objects, even though they're in glass boxes and, you know, a bit like a museum, doesn't matter, go to each one, put your hands together like this, and sincerely from your heart say to the holy object, may I be just like you. So important when we see holy objects, not see them as external, causal refuge, but internal refuge. May I be just like you. That's what Chinrezi is here for. Not an external sign, but when we come in here, this most beautiful Chinrezi, we should put our hands together and really think, may I be just like you. Because that is the goal. When you're meditating on bodhicitta, you know, let me say, meditate on bodhicitta, what do you focus on? Do you focus on suffering sentient beings? No. When you meditate on bodhicitta, you should meditate on Buddhahood, on your future enlightenment. May I be just like you, you know? I want to become a Buddha. We have to constantly bring to mind the intention to attain enlightenment for the welfare of all sentient beings. So that the object of meditation of bodhicitta is Buddhahood. Not worshipping as an external thing, but your inner attainment of Buddhahood. That is the Mahayana refuge. Anyway. Now you can take refuge in the restaurants. And we dedicate the positive energy of this morning session to our attainment of Buddhahood, right? And then we'll meet after lunch, 1:30. Thank you so much.